Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Judith Levine. I'm on the faculty in the Sociology Department at Temple University in Philadelphia, and I also run a research center called the Public Policy Lab.
Now, Prof. Levine, before I ask my standard question, I get puzzled by this use of the word laboratory or lab. I get it when you have a Bunsen burner or a pipette. I've never actually understood why people have arts labs, policy labs. Is it to make it look more scientific? I mean, don't answer if you don't want to.
Okay, off the record, even though I know we're on the record. I think it does show this sort of dominance of the bench sciences, and that the other parts of the university are latching on to that. And I do have mixed feelings about the use, but it is it has become very common. And one thing I do really like about it is I think it does create the image of like getting your hands dirty and working it out and coming together and everyone being in a room. And that is a lot of the mission of what we're doing. So I really like that aspect of it. But I can't deny this other part that you mentioned.
No, but I get the point. And of course, when doing public policy, you are experimenting. You are thinking of tossing around ideas about what would and wouldn't work. And it is best done collaboratively. I understand all of that. So apologies for my crass cynicism. Prof. JL, I'd like to ask you if you would share with us what's currently obsessing you, retarding you, animating you, dynamizing you, interesting you.
I am thinking a lot about two things, which I see as very tightly related, although in the world of the academy, they're kind of siloed in different places, but I think they need to be brought together more. So the first thing I'm thinking about, which stems from my whole line of research, is that COVID in the US provided the kind of social transformation and political will for a very brief moment to almost solve poverty. And then we turned away. So we kind of had a transformative moment and then it passed. And I think a lot about that and just kind of the roller coaster that people who study poverty and social welfare policy have been on in the US over the last few years. So that's one thing. I'm sure we'll talk more about that. The other thing is my actual research that I'm engaged with right now, which is a study in which I'm following a cohort of 100 young people. I started following them when they were college seniors, and I have done in-depth qualitative interviews with them over 2 years as they transition from college through graduation and into the labor market. And I'm looking at differences across class and race and ethnicity and gender in what that experience is like. And that is kind of a departure for me, but it stemmed intellectually from my getting frustrated that all of us who work in poverty, we always write the same conclusion to our books, which is, I've just shown you that poverty is really bad and we should do something about it. And there's nothing that we can do that's politically feasible, the end. And so I have written such a book with such a conclusion.
I was going to say, this is a rather cruel adumbration of Ain't No Trust, but nevertheless.
Well, I'm glad you think I might have said something more valuable than just that. But so I wanted to look at something that is a solution to poverty, although it's not always talked about as a solution to poverty, and that is the college degree, which is held up as the ticket to the middle class. And I had suspicions that that might not work the same for all people. And I wanted to see what that looks like in action as it unfolds. And so that's what led to that second study. So it may seem like, why a Southerner studies poverty, suddenly studying higher ed. Those are two different sections in, you know, the sociology meetings. But I see them as connected in that way.
I wrote a rather too utopian book called A COVID Charter that came out 2 or 3 years ago, based on my having lived through those first two waves in Mexico, but also my experience of living in Colombia, Britain, and the United States in terms of healthcare issues. And I thought this might be a moment of transformation. If only people had, taken their money out of the banks and the mutual funds, put it under the mattress and read my book, we would have a Pacific socialism. Tell me why, for you, this was also a potential moment of transformation that didn't quite come true. Is it because we didn't have a Bobby Kennedy?
Well, I do think it's because we have enormous political polarization. Although, I'll come back to why I think it failed, but let me tell you what I think happened. And you can also jump in and say how you think things were different in other countries, because the US is, I don't know if it's a unique case, but it does have its particularities. As people, I know you have an impressively global audience. So, as people may or may not be aware, the US was really late to get any kind of systematic social welfare state. And really, we didn't have what we would call our social welfare state until FDR and the stock market crash. And so, the stock market crash, 1929, was kind of like COVID, this sort of incredible crisis that affected everyone, that was impossible to ignore, that obviously the government had to address, and that created some sympathy and will, goodwill across class. So during COVID, there was enormous appreciation for people who did minimum wage work. And they were the heroes, the people who ventured out and delivered our groceries and toilet paper, and who worked as cashiers and let themselves be exposed to this virus. So there was a lot of appreciation for the hard work and the value that, of course, was always there, but that a lot of middle class people didn't appreciate before, and upper middle class people didn't appreciate before. So there was appreciation, and also realization that anyone could be thrown out of work, anyone could get sick, et cetera, even though there were differences in who did lose work and who did get sick. But everyone felt vulnerable. And so there was support for more universal systems, both in FDR's time, and that's what led to the passage of the Social Security Act of 1935, which put in place like everything we have, not everything, but many of the things we have as part of our social welfare state on the federal level. And there was again kind of will, and President Trump did put in place some of these things, but President Biden came in and really tried to be systematic. And expansive, and not just kind of dealing with the emergency, and lots of, President Trump's policies were set to expire very quickly. And President Biden wanted to make these more permanent and longer term. And so he devised what he called the American Rescue Plan. And a key feature of that, there were a lot of parts of it, but what I'll zero in on is something called the Expanded Child Tax Credit. We had a child tax credit. This is the expanded child tax credit. Sometimes wonky language is not that exciting, but really, the devil is in the details. And if you really read the difference between the two, expanded and not expanded, there is a big difference. So the expanded child tax credit gave families with children more money. It made it the benefit refundable, which I'm going to say what that is in a minute, and made more people eligible. It reached very high up into the income distribution. So instead of it being a targeted policy just on low-income people. It was a more universal policy that many people benefited from, which is expensive, but it means it's less stigmatized on just low-income people, and it has more political support because everyone benefits. The refundable thing, it used to be that if you didn't make enough money to pay taxes, you didn't benefit from this thing. And now, if you don't make enough money to owe taxes, you still get the benefit. So under the expanded. So this was in place for a year, and it had unbelievable effects on poverty. So it cut child poverty by 50%. That's a really big number. And critics were really worried that people would use it to buy luxuries. And why are we paying taxes so other people can buy flat screen TVs? And they were worried that people would stop working. And why are we paying taxes so people leave the labor market? It turned out that none of these things happened. And the number one thing people used it for was food. Hard to say that's a luxury. And it didn't lower work effort. Now, some people say it wasn't in place long enough and you would have seen the work effects later. Okay. But it did have these really big effects without any obvious drawbacks in terms of those concerns, should you have had those concerns. Biden tried to make it permanent and it lost by one vote in the Senate. Joe Manchin didn't support it. He is a Democrat who is
From West Virginia.
not a progressive Democrat, shall we summarize. So it had a lot of support. And it had some support of Republicans. It really was an effective policy. And lots of times people throw up their hands like, oh, it's such an intractable problem. It's so hard to solve po poverty. And of course, aspects of it are very hard to address. But here was one simple policy that seemed to really, really have a huge effect. And I think there are other sort of social aspects of it, which we could get into a little later, maybe when I talk about my book, because it really relates to things in my book that I thought were really beneficial. And it's like a lot of us who really care about children, who really care about poverty reduction, who see the United States as kind of had this long history of not liking universal policies and stigmatizing the poor into separate categories of policy. A lot of us saw this as like, a new dawn. And it passed. It did not pass. And so the moment passed. And it's, we literally were on a roller coaster. I teach a poverty class, and like every semester, I had a completely different, like, hey, no, hey. It was sort of, just up and down in terms of what I was saying about the future of poverty policy in America.
Prof, I have a comment and a question, if I may. The comment is that one of the key things Biden tried to do, which is smart, and the history of public policy shows it to be necessary in so-called what we used to call advanced industrial societies, ho ho ho, which is if you target the poor, you're fucked. It won't work. You have to make the middle class beneficiaries of welfare. Because if you make them beneficiaries of welfare, guess what? They don't want to lose it. They'll support it. And the stigmatization that you've described is more difficult to pin onto people. And of course, if you orient it to families, then reactionaries are going to love it. Sort of general point, not restricted to the United States, but all over the world. One of the problems with, for example, redistribution of income through government from the middle class to the working class in Mexico or Venezuela is that this has alienated the middle class and left the ruling class completely intact. So my question is this. Okay, a lot of FDR's reform stayed in place. Was that in part because of the war?
I think certainly that is part of what made people think that we that it extended people's feeling of vulnerability, like everyone that we need a safety net, that it is unpredictable. It's unpredictable who's going to lose their life savings in the stock market. It's unpredictable. I mean, a huge percentage of the, young male population went to that war. It's unpredictable who's going to have a death in the family, who's going to lose a son, a husband, a father, who's going to have a lifelong medical condition to deal with. I think the war did extend people's feeling that we have to take care of each other and extend a community feeling. And that's something that we really lost in later decades, mostly kind of after the sort of unrest in the 60s when kind of white and middle class America turned their backs on many of these issues.
So I want to get onto your book very quickly, but before that, could I ask you about the Great Society reforms, the major contribution along with civil rights legislation that LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, was in large part responsible for, that Bobby Kennedy, unlike his bastard son, was crucial in and would have expanded. I think there's no doubt. I think he would have won 68 election. I think he would have won the nomination. I think he would have won the election. I think Vietnam would not have gone on in the way that it did. If. I understand all of that. But for people not knowing this history, could you tell them about that brief shining moment that failed, that was destroyed from,
Right.
say, 65 to 68, 69?
Right.
That be about right chronologically,
Yeah,
Prof.
that's about right. So, John F. Kennedy, President Kennedy, sort of, it's referred to as, and of course, I think this is a little bit of offensive, rediscovered poverty. I mean, poverty was there, but it is true that post-war, there was this immense attention to poverty in the 30s and the creation of the social welfare state. The war, great, obviously that was a huge distraction, but still great concern for well-being and for there being some kind of a safety net. But post-war, people were happy the war was over. The 1950s were, on average, a very prosperous period. And so there was much less attention paid to these issues. And then President Kennedy is said to have rediscovered poverty. The story goes that he read Michael Harrington's The Other America, and it opened his eyes about like this incredible poverty that was happening in rural white America and Appalachia. I don't, I wasn't there while he was reading the book, so I don't know if that's exactly true, but that is what the story is.
I think
And
he
so,
was reading From Russia with Love by Ian Fleming.
oh, maybe that's what it was. Maybe I mixed up my books.
In no, I mean, he keep, that's meant to be the beginning of James Bond in the US, right? That JFK told Life magazine, these are my top 10 favorite books. And suddenly,
I
hundreds
missed
of
that.
thousands of copies were sold. Anyway, sorry to interrupt. Yeah, Michael Harrington's book
We
is a
didn't cover
landmark.
James Bond in my poverty classes in grad school.
You've got to mention it. Michael Harrington's book is a landmark in a kind of anti-Marxist liberal left US thinking. Really important. Really a real landmark, no?
Yes. So Kennedy wanted to really address poverty, and he gave the charge to, we didn't even have a poverty line. We didn't have a way to measure poverty. And so he gave the charge to create a measure, which Molly Ryshansky, an economist in the Bureau of Labor Statistics, developed. She said this has to be temporary. It's not perfect. Of course, we're still with it, and it's a very problematic measure. I don't blame her because she knew it was problematic. I blame those who didn't perfect it earlier. We now have an alternate line, which addresses many of the problems, and they kind of side by side get published every year. But I mean, I'm just saying that, like, that's how much we weren't paying attention, that we didn't even have a measure, and we didn't kind of know how many people we would want to call in poverty. So Kennedy was planning to have programming on this, and then, of course, tragically, he was assassinated, and Lyndon Baines Johnson became president. And he and Kennedy, many tensions between their kind of two camps. And so I think people weren't quite sure what Johnson would do, but he really took on the mantle of this, and he carried the Kennedy legacy forward in this respect. And he created the War on Poverty and what was later named the Great Society. Quick aside, I just was hearing Doris Kearns Goodwin, the amazing historian, presidential historian, who's written a memoir on the 60s, talking about her husband being a speechwriter for Lyndon Baines Johnson and being very involved in the naming of the Great Society. So I haven't read that book yet, but I'll have
Well,
to go look at that.
the term was coined in 1917 by Graham Wallace.
I actually don't know that history. Say more.
Well, Wallace, he wrote a book during the First World War called The Great Society. It's all in there. Doris Kearns Goodwin may mention this in her memoir. She may not. But Lipman, Walter
Let's hope she
Lipman,
gives Wallace
was
credit.
one of the Wallace people. And Lippmann pushed this idea along with John Dewey. Anyway, sorry to interrupt, but
So she
it's
actually
worth,
refers
you might be
to
interested in having a look at the book.
Yeah,
It
I
really is
will.
1917, Graham Wallace. I'm pretty sure, I'll look it up while we're talking. I'm pretty sure it's called The Great Society. But he's certainly in that book, which, believe it or not, for my sins, I read.
She mentioned a different name at first, which I'm now not remembering, and Great Society is definitely a better name.
Well, he was a British guy who, that's right, 1914, sorry, The Great Society, A Psychological Analysis. And basically, what he does is say that the Industrial Revolution has created all sorts of problems. We need to do something about it. And that's what gets picked up in the vision. I think Lippmann is the interlocutor. Anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt because you're giving a reviewer account of something that I don't understand it as well as you do. So I'm going to cut the mansplaining right there.
Okay, back to Johnson and the 60s and his Great Society. So he, he pushed forward, a huge sort of a whole agenda of policies, the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. And he put Sergeant Shriver, who that's a name, not a title, Sergeant Shriver, who was Kennedy's brother-in-law, married to Eunice, and he put him in charge of programming. And a promise was made of very transformative change. There, it almost immediately, there were competing visions, as there often are. There were competing tensions over like redistribution versus job training. So job training is more of a like help people help themselves than actually, make society more equal. So there's two ways to make change. You can get everyone the human capital so that they may rise through a system without changing the system, or you can change the system so that there isn't so much inequality from top to bottom. And there were these kinds of tensions, as this was all, there was also people who wanted to push for more community involvement. So this wasn't top down, but bottom up. There were political factions who were concerned that that was giving too much power to to people outside of government and to the non-elites, and let's be blunt, to Black people. Race was, race and racial tensions and race inequality was, flowing through all of this, all of these political discussions. And so through all of these tensions, what actually passed and what actually happened was less transformative, systematic, big, than was the original vision and the original promise. And through those frustrations, related to those frustrations, related to what was happening in Vietnam, there ultimately was racial unrest in many cities, and white suburban America saw cities burning and kind of turned away their political support from this, turned away, and with a throwing up of hands and, like, look, we tried to do something and look how we're thanked kind of attitude. It's a total tragedy that not more came of it. I think a lot of people, for a long time kind of said, we fought, a war on poverty and poverty won kind of attitude about this. There was at the 50th anniversary of the Great Society, there was kind of a re appreciation for what Johnson did and what Kennedy set in motion. And there certainly were expansions in the welfare rolls. People who I mean, a huge problem is that Black people in America, even if they had rights, and this is the story of race in America, that even when people have rights on paper, they didn't have rights in actuality because of how things were implemented. So, you could have the right to vote, but if you show up at the polling place and you're intimidated, then you don't really have the right to vote. Or if there are poll taxes and grandfather clauses and literacy tests and all sorts of things that kept people from having the right to vote in practice. Similar things happened here. You could have the right to have public assistance benefits, what is often called welfare, although that's not, there's a lot of things that we should be calling welfare, but we call this one thing welfare. But you can have rights, but if a caseworker doesn't actually give them to you, or there are shenanigans around kind of the rules of eligibility that cut out one group versus another group, you don't actually have the right in practice. So Black people in America were sort of did get access to benefits in a new way during this period. Certainly not perfect, but there was a large expansion in the roles. There were program expansions. There were job training programs, some of which still exist today. I think there was a renewed appreciation for what happened in the 60s, even though many people still conclude that not enough was done. And then we kind of slid into the 80s and Reagan and the first Bush and the kind of takeover of this idea of workfare, that that there should be work requirements for getting these benefits. And that, when first introduced, was incredibly controversial and now has become just, completely accepted. And we now have, some states have work requirements to receive Medicaid, which is our low-income health insurance program. So this idea, I can't believe I've talked to you this long about this and haven't yet said that American welfare policy is very wedded to this idea of the deserving versus the undeserving. And that's what's guided a lot of this, and that we America only likes to give benefits to people we deem deserving. And for able-bodied adults, one One way one is observing is by working for pay in the labor market. And so that's why there is often this attachment of work requirements, and also why there's this kind of obsession with policies that might create work disincentives. And there's room for a variety of opinions here. And even if you think that, it's a problem if there are work disincentives or that we want to promote work, sometimes this is taken to the extreme that people who, really can't be in the labor market or people who really have severe need for certain benefits are cut off, and often cut off without, an explanation or without warning. And then this led into from the 80s, we led into 1990s welfare reform, and we in America have sort of the signature thing that happened in 1996 that we call welfare reform, which kind of it took away a federal entitlement to cash public assistance for low-income families. It attached work requirements, it attached lifetime time limits of 60 months or 5 years cumulative over the life course. And this was passed in 1996, implemented in 1997. And that's kind of, the current policy in a sense.
And Prof, this takes us to the point where I think we can talk about your incredible book, Eight
Oh,
Year
thank
Mindset,
you.
which has as its subtitle, I'm reading from my copy now, How Bosses, Boyfriends, and Bureaucrats, at various times I've been all of those things, How Bosses, Boyfriends, and Bureaucrats Fail Low-Income Mothers and Why It Matters. And I guess you've already pointed to the racial impact of these issues. To give people some context, in 1965, well over 85% of the US population was deemed white, and almost everybody who was not deemed white was African American in that dispensation. Today, it's more like 60% white and 40% split, African, Latino, sort of 16 to 18%, African American, 13, 14%, Asian American, and then much smaller percentages, Native American and others. But one of the things you explain in the book, and you start in a sense with the 90s, but you bring us well into the 21st century because you have, in a sense, two cohorts that you've worked with in different times, one for the doctorate, the other for the book, in a certain sense, I think it's right to say.
Right.
You really bring gender to the fore because it's people like me who, as bosses, boyfriends, and bureaucrats, who are part of the problem for the women that you interview, who rightly lack trust in these guys.
Yeah, so I started the book, welfare reform, as I just described, this 1990s policy, was being very hotly debated when I first started thinking about this. And so it was really going to be a book about welfare reform. And I did interviews with one cohort, and then I kind of moved away into different kinds of work. And then I came back to it and interviewed a new cohort to see how, like, well, what's ha now that welfare reform is firmly in place, what is happening? And when I did this second group of interviews, it became incredibly clear to me that an overarching, palpable, all-encompassing issue for women at both these time periods in the mid-90s and 10 years later, was distrust. How strongly they distrusted in every area of their lives. And so the book is made up of chapters on five different contexts. One is the welfare office and distrust in caseworkers. One is low-wage work and distrust in supervisors. One is boyfriends, romantic partners, and one is childcare workers who take care of their children and their distrust in where their children are being taken care of. And then finally, their own personal networks of family and friends. And that distrust kind of operated in similar ways. And before any listeners think that, like, I'm blaming these women for being distrustful, quite the opposite. I argue that it makes a lot of sense that if you are in contexts where you're interacting with people who are not trustworthy or who do not share your interests, that you are right to be distrustful, and that what we have to do is change the context so that people are engaging in more trustful ways. So, I mean, just to take the welfare office, since that's kind of what we're talking about, caseworkers, many caseworkers are good people. They went into this because they wanted to help people. But they are in a structure, and this structure is formed through politicians and policy and a social structure, and they kind of have to respond in a certain way. They have some leeway, but not a lot of leeway. And so they are under great pressure to either not sign people up for benefits to dissuade them or to cut them off, especially post welfare reform. And all of their rewards, all of their pressures are about that. And no rewards come from extending people's benefits. And they also, prior to welfare reform, their job was to cut people checks and their actual checks when there were actual checks. And post welfare reform, their jobs suddenly were much more complicated. They were supposed to be social workers, essentially. And they had to do this without any real training to do it. So their interests and the interests of the client coming in who might have desperate need, are really opposite. And this is like a laboratory for distrust. When there are opposing interests and when people have different amounts of power, that is really a recipe for distrust. So, and we know that trust is actually a very valuable commodity, and that the middle class and the rich benefit enormously from the fact that they are able to interact with institutions that they can trust. It sort of lubricates and smooths business practices and all sorts of outcomes. Distrust is kind of the opposite. Distrust puts the stop on things. Distrust means people can't make things happen. And so people who are in situations where it's not safe to trust others are at a real disadvantage. And so that's what I argue in the book, that we have to make it so that people are treated better, so people are that when we make a promise to people, we come through with it. And distrust is also fomented when you feel others don't trust you. And low-income mothers are some of the most distrusted people in our society and in our kind of cultural conversation. The problem is not, the low-wage labor market. The problem is low-income mothers, in this viewpoint, not in my viewpoint, in this viewpoint. And so low-income mothers are not stupid. They know that this is the image of them and that they are treated as takers and as the problem. And knowing that, they, too, are distrustful in a system that distrusts them. So that's what the book's about. And why, just getting back to this expanded child tax credit, why I saw it as not only actually getting money into the hands of people who need it to take care of their children, and not only cutting child poverty in half, it also sort of got rid of much of this problem of stigma and distrust, because it puts everyone into the same system, low-income mothers and, middle-class mothers, even upper middle-class mothers. I think people got benefits of this. I'd have to look at the numbers to get this exactly right, but up until about 100 family income of $150,000, which is, well over more than twice median income in the US. So it reaches very high up into the income distribution, and It puts everyone into the same system. It's run through the tax system, so it's kind of invisible. You don't have to march into a welfare office and stand in a line. This happens kind of automatically through the tax system. And so it gets rid of a lot of the stuff I'm talking about, and a lot of the kind of personal intrusion in the book I talk about. Caseworkers would ask mothers like when the last time they had sex and who did they have sex with, and would sort of like be, saying this publicly in a big open office. And why were they asking those questions? Because they're trying to establish a paternity, because they're trying to go after child support payments from the biological father of the child. And that, should biological fathers be paying for their children? Yes, of course, if they have been, educated, if they have jobs, if they are, not struggling to put food in their own mouths as well. So it's not that this is a bad thing that you're trying to get money from non-custodial parents, but it is a bad thing when you sort of publicly make people tell you about their sex lives in order to feed their children. So it gets rid of that dynamic. And so those were kind of the social benefits that I saw of this policy.
And I think it's that even-handedness along with commitment that really makes your work stand out, as opposed to my crass ultra-leftism, for example. But, Prof, I'd like to ask you two more questions, if I may, and then throw to you to add anything you might wish as a means of concluding. Does that sound okay?
Sounds good.
So my first of my last two questions I've been allocated. Is to ask you about the new work you're doing on these cohorts of young people transitioning from study to work and the long-standing US nostrum, the donne of all life in the fantasy of meritocracy, that if you study hard, you'll get ahead. Is it true? Is it not? What have you found out, Doc? Spill the beans here in the lab.
Okay, I have students who are about to give me final papers, so I'm going to say yes.
Go to temple. Your life will be much better.
If you want to interview me after the papers are in, then maybe we'll have a different conversation. But seriously, so I've moved to this work where I'm following this cohort of students who are going through senior year graduation into the labor market. As I said, I started this because we hold up the college degree as kind of the ticket to middle class security, in an increasingly precarious labor market. I was interested in whether this looks the same across social class, across race and ethnicity, across gender. And so I have a sample that has variation on all of those things. After I, it's funny, even in the time I'm working on this, which is, several years now, it takes a long time to get permission, to raise grant money, to get IRB approval, to do the interviews, et cetera. Even over that period of time, the conversation has really changed. So when I started, the conversation was really that college is a great equalizer. And that's a term, I kind of like that term, and it's a term that's used in a lot of the work, that if people coming out of the same colleges with the same majors have the same employment rates and income levels across class background. And most of this work is on class rather than race or gender. And so college is a great equalizer. So I was like, well, at the same time, there's other that's quantitative work that looks systematically across graduates. There's qualitative work that's showing that students of different class backgrounds and different racial identities and sexualities and gender identities actually have really different experiences in college, and that there's different kind of experiences of inclusion or exclusion while they're at college, different comfort in tapping certain resources while at college. So I was trying to kind of, I'm trying to look, and I'm early on. I'm like sitting on 20,000 pages of transcripts and trying to make sense of it all. I know it's really that face you just made is how I feel about it sometimes. But so you know, my story may change once I've really finished analyzing everything. But at the moment, what I'm kind of arguing is that while quantitative findings, you know, are extremely valuable, and I do some quantitative work as well, extremely valuable and broad findings across many populations are extremely valuable, but that they do mask kind of the nitty-gritty experience. So my sample as well, across, let's just talk about first generation students compared to continuing generation students, generation people whose neither parent has a 4-year college degree, continuing, at least one parent has a 4-year college degree. Those two groups are actually employed at the same rate and are making the same amount of money in my sample as well. And that kind of mirrors what's found in the quantitative, which is, you know, really interesting. It's kind of not what I expected, and it's really interesting. And it's heartening. Like, that's a good thing. However, that does not mean that the experience is the same. And for those, if you just compare the two groups, if you take people who are unemployed in the year or two after college or underemployed, by which I mean they're working part-time, you know, the standard barista story, or working part-time in a, you know, as a cashier in a store or selling clothes, as opposed to something in their, you know, full-time in their line of study, of, you know, that sets them up for a career. If you compare first generation students and continuing generation students who are in that situation, there is much greater hardship for the first generation students. So the continuing generation students have a lot of familial support. Often they can live with their families. Often there is an empty spare bedroom in which they live with their families. And they often don't pay rent. They often have all their food supplied. And they're completely stressed out and anxious and worried. And yes, they too are facing a precarious labor market. I'm not saying they're living high off the hog. This is a stressful situation. But compared to the first generation students who, some of my students have got, some of the students or the former students are receiving government benefits. SNAP is the official name, but what many people call food stamps in the American system. Some of whom are really, you know, like couch surfing, living on friends' couches, you know, don't really have some place that they can call home. They're in very dire economic situations. And so that's a qualitative difference. And that's what gets masked by, you know, these kind of on average, you know, median income numbers. And then the second thing I'm finding is that to the degree that college is a great equalizer, like these students who are having this different experience ending up in the same place, that's kind of a like conundrum. How does that happen? What I'm finding is the continuing generation students, the children of the college graduates, they have personal networks. Their parents know somebody. They are, you know, like the mother talks to the aunt who has the friend who works in the DA's office. Whereas the continuing generation students, they don't have those contacts in their personal networks. And instead, they're getting those contacts through their professional experiences and through their, you know, internships and through professors and through the university, through the professional development office at the university. So this does point to a real role and a power that universities have to create equality, and that the universities, I think, are increasingly recognizing that they have to step up and do this stuff, that they're not there just to teach students critical thinking, but they also have to help connect students to social networks. They have to kind of mimic the personal networks that more engaged students. students have. So those are the kinds of things I'm thinking about in that work at this moment.
Fantastic. Just to give people a little bit of context, the acronym IRB means Institutional Review Board, often referred to in lesser countries as an ethics committee. And it's where you get permission to do human subjects experimentation. It basically arises from the Nuremberg trials and the Holocaust and unsolicited and brutal experiments on victims of the Holocaust. And it's about getting informed consent. It's really about medicine, but it gets deployed aggressively against ethnographers. It has benefits and its value, and it also its limitations. Other quick thing for those interested in these topics, podcasts in this series have featured episodes with Neil Krause, with John Shelton, and with Steve Brint, looking at some of these questions. So my second thing I wanted to ask you, Prof, before throwing to you to conclude, is I wondered if I could quote you something from Bobby Kennedy speaking to the University of Kansas during his ill-fated, in the sense of assassinated, campaign in 1968. For sure you know this speech. So I'm quoting when he says, "Our gross national product counts air pollution and cigarette advertising and ambulances to clear our highways of carnage. It counts special locks for our doors and the jails for people who break them. It counts the destruction of the redwood and the loss of our natural wonder in chaotic sprawl. It counts napalm and counts nuclear warheads and armored cars for the police. It excludes the health of our children, the quality of their education, the joy of their play, the beauty of our poetry." Here's one I particularly like: "the intelligence of our public debate." This always makes me cry. It's like watching the moment of singing La Marseillaise in Casablanca, you know, where it just gets the tears moving. Now, Bobby was no saint by any means, a brutal anti-communist and a real, what the Spanish call a galán with women sexually, but he touched on something. Is that still there in the United States?
I mean, that's such a beautiful quote, and it is so meaningful. And I just as you were talking, I of course the thing I think about when I think about what's in GNP and what isn't is the work that parents do and homemakers do. And that this is disproportionately done by women, and that the fact that it's not included means that it's not appreciated and it's not considered work. And that's really one of the biggest problems with the very programs that the Kennedys and later Johnson were so invested in, is that, you know, because we don't value the rearing of children and don't recognize it as work. We are putting all of these quote work requirements on low-income mothers, which means many children spend long hours without their mothers. They spend long hours in quality childcare, and we know increasingly how important those early years of development are. Kids do great in childcare when it's high-quality childcare. They do great in preschool when it's high-quality preschool. Preschool. So this is not an argument that mothers shouldn't be in the workforce. This is an argument that we need to be paying and recognizing for the work of children being in good situations in their early years. So that's when you started reading the quote, that is where my mind went.
Sure.
But I will also say that, you know, as the way the quote develops, that poetry isn't included and high-minded debate isn't included. I mean, I think this also relates to this incredible backlash that we're experiencing right now against higher education, and this movement. We don't have another hour to get into this, but I know that Steve Brint talked about this and your other guests. But that we as a society, are blaming higher education And there is this movement to make higher education be incredibly tied to specific skills as opposed to critical thinking and communication, verbal and written communication, and that we are trying to train workers, which is an important thing to do. And I think we owe our students who are paying enormous amounts in tuition that they can get a job afterwards. But we're forgetting that we're also training citizens. And I don't mean about legality of citizenry. I just mean members of society. We are training people who can think about how to make a better world, how to work with each other, how to spread ideas and feelings. And, you know, I don't want to be in a society where we don't have people who think that's important. And so this backlash against higher ed is very concerning in very practical ways, but also in broader social and ethical ways.
We offer a wonderful corrective to the patriarchy of the Kennedy clan and my welcoming citation of them. The only reference he makes of that kind in the speech, Bobby, is to talk about the exclusion of the strength of our marriages from GDP. Prof Levine, I wonder if there are things we haven't yet touched on that you would like to mention in closing, or areas that we have discussed, but where you want to add something more.
Well, I think we covered a lot, and I'm really glad we came to the higher ed and were are able to connect it back. Again, I think that we didn't talk too much about like barriers to access to higher education. There are many barriers. There are information barriers. There are financial barriers. The cost of, and again, you know, listeners in other parts of the world, you know, may be shocked if they look at the sticker price of American university educations these days, especially private, but public as well. There has been a retrenchment of public support for public education. And so the costs are being passed on to the students, and low-income students are being asked to go into very high levels of debt, not everywhere. And sometimes students get a free ride, and sometimes the elite universities are actually better able to provide one than less elite universities. But still, student debt is extremely high. And so this is part of the problem of the question of is college worth it? My answer is still yes for most people, most majors, most universities. But there are students for whom there is increasing risk that college won't pay off, and that has a lot to do with student debt. And I sort of started talking about access and somehow moved into the outcome. But we have problems with both access and with the payoff. And these are really class-based distinctions and inequalities.
Prof. Levine, thank you so much for your generous sharing of your thoughts, your research, your brilliance. It's been wonderful having this chance to chat to you.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.